Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Consider this from this week's guest, Sandor Katz, who said, "Between fresh and rotten, there's a creative space in which the most compelling flavors arise."
Cultures that evolved in different places have different microbial communities, and each community has certain unique aspects which can contribute unique aspects to the flavor.
Sandor is the author of The Art of Fermentation. Now, with it, you could launch a lifetime of new discoveries. Sandor has done that all over the world, seeking out fermented foods. He's already got a cult following of fermentos. Now, what you have to know is that before industry, food fell into just three categories: the raw, the cooked, and the fermented. Stay with us for your calls and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You may be a foodie, you may be a foodist, that's a grown-up foodie, but are you a fermento? They're getting pretty thick on the ground, and this is a new use of an old noun, meaning something that brings about fermentation. Now, it also describes people hooked on fermenting, from cheese to kimchi, cassava breads to yogurt. The underground movement surfaced big time when Sandor Katz, a master fermento, wrote the exceptional book, The Art of Fermentation, an in-depth exploration of essential concepts and processes from around the world. Sandor, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on the show, Lynn.
So, you know, we get a lot of questions about making your own yogurt. And as I see it, it's a pretty finicky process. So can you explain what the steps are and what's behind them?
Sure. Well, I love to make yogurt, and I make yogurt pretty regularly at home. What makes yogurt kind of tricky is that the bacteria that are involved are part of a group of bacteria known as thermophilic bacteria, meaning that they are at their most active at elevated temperatures. So yogurt requires some incubation, or, you know, creating a warm temperature zone to support this thermophilic activity. The way I do it, which is pretty simple and uses tools that most people have in their household, is I take an insulated cooler and I preheat it with warm water. So I bring it up to the target temperature, which is between 110 and 115 degrees Fahrenheit. And then meanwhile, I take the milk that I want to turn into yogurt and I heat it up even warmer than that. Usually my target is about 180 degrees Fahrenheit. And basically, this heating does a couple of different things. I mean, first of all, it sort of kills any bacteria that are in the milk so that there's sort of nothing to compete with the bacteria that you're introducing,
right,
which are the yogurt bacterias. And then also, the heating denatures the proteins, which enables them to be restructured by the bacterial fermentation, and you know that's really the magic that re-knits a liquid milk into a solid, which is what yogurt is. So that's what makes it kind of challenging, is because there's all this temperature manipulation involved. So I heat it up to 180, and then I cool it down to about 115, and then I introduce a small amount of the starter, which is just a mature batch of yogurt, and then I get it into that incubator and hold it between 110 and 115 degrees Fahrenheit. 4 to 8 hours in that range is generally plenty of time to get the yogurt to sit, become solid.
Now, how do you maintain that temperature inside that cooler for all of that time? Because the warm water you put in has been poured out, hasn't it?
Well, I usually actually leave the warm water in. So I try to get it up to the top of that range, 115 degrees.
Right.
And then I also preheat the jars that I add the milk and the yogurt culture to. And I usually leave the thermometer in there. And then somewhere after a few hours, I'll just briefly open it up and look at the thermometer. And if it seems like it needs warming up, I'll add a little bit of boiling water just to bring it back up a few degrees.
Now, what about the culture? I can use a yogurt. Would be a plain yogurt, right, that I buy in the store.
I mean, you could use any plain yogurt as a starter. The problem is that that'll be great for one batch. It'll be pretty good for the second batch. By the third, fourth, fifth generation, it will be less and less yogurt-like. After wondering about this, kind of paradox for some years, because, of course, how could a food have gotten passed down for generation after generation if it didn't really have the ability to effectively perpetuate itself? I finally got a hold of what I would call an heirloom yogurt culture, which is really different than the ones that are in use by commercial manufacturers. The commercial manufacturers are using starters based upon isolated bacterial strains, a couple of them added together, whereas the traditional heirloom cultures were literally these evolved communities of bacteria that have a structure to them, and part of that structure is really defense strategies to sort of protect themselves as a community from other random bacteria in the environment. So these heirloom cultures, which are available online if you search for them, you know, really can give you something that you can use over and over and over again. And I would estimate that I've done about 60 generations from the Bulgarian heirloom culture that I've been using.
Can you control that flavor and texture with the kind of culture that you use? Or is it the amount of fat in the yogurt? Or is it the time? Tell me how I can make the yogurt I'm dreaming of.
It's everything you've just mentioned, Lynn. I mean, the culture itself has implications for the flavor because, cultures that evolved in different places have different microbial communities. And each community has certain unique aspects which can contribute unique aspects to the flavor. But time always plays a role because in any fermentation, the acids accumulate over time. So, a longer fermentation always has the potential to be more acidic than a shorter fermentation. So if you specifically prefer a sharper flavor, the solution would be to ferment it for a longer time. The type of milk certainly also has implications for the flavor and the texture. One technique that I learned from a woman from Turkey is if you want your yogurt to be thick, hold it at that 180 degree heat for 15 minutes before you cool it down. And just the evaporation that happens during that time, you'll be starting with a thicker milk and ending with a thicker yogurt. And also you can strain the yogurt after it's fermented. I mean, that's how most of the Greek yogurts are made. You take a few layers of cheesecloth or any kind of a clean cotton cloth and put the yogurt in it and then hang it, and you'll just have whey dripping out of that. Mm-hmm. And you can make it a little bit thicker, or you can make it a lot thicker, something like cream cheese or even a harder cheese than that, all depending upon how long you leave it dripping.
You are the master, sir. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Sandor Katz is author of The Art of Fermentation. Now, start your fermenting by following his yogurt making guide, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. A little food science can take you a long way down the road to dishes that always shine. Now, chefs understand this, which is why many well-known ones work with food scientist Harold McGee. He's always digging for new answers. He's never accepting the status quo. Now, Harold is the author of Keys to Good Cooking, a guide to making the best of foods and recipes. Harold, it's good to have you back with us.
It's wonderful to be back with you, Lynn. Thanks.
I want to talk to you about thawing food fast, because you did an article about thawing meat in hot water. And, all the experts have always said, never in a million years should you ever thaw meat in hot water. You always do it in cold water. So what's the deal?
Well, that's exactly it. And in fact, most of the time what people told you to do is thaw, leaving things in the refrigerator. which is, in a way, the worst of all possible worlds for the cook, because, yeah, that might be the safest way to do something, but it takes forever. I mean, a one-inch thick steak can take 24 hours to thaw out in the refrigerator. So, so the next best thing was to put it in cold water, ice water, and water is just a much better transmitter of heat than air is. And so when you put something in water, it'll transfer heat in or out of the food much more quickly. And so you can thaw a piece of beef in cold water. It might take 24 hours in the fridge. It would take maybe 1 hour, 2 hours in cold water. But that's still quite a while. And the thing that I think most authorities were worried about was people just kind of taking food out of the fridge, putting it on the countertop and letting it warm up at room temperature, which takes a long time and isn't safe because bacteria can grow at the surface of the food while the inside is still thawing out. But then about 18 months ago, two different food science labs actually did a controlled study to see what would happen when you thawed meat at different temperatures in water baths. And what they discovered was that meat, one-inch thick steak, will thaw in about 20 minutes in room temperature water and more like 10 or 11 minutes in water that's 100 degrees or so, so like a hot summer day.
Right, right.
And it turns out that if you do the math, which these labs did, those thawing times are so short that they don't give bacteria a chance to get growing and cause any trouble. So it turns out that thawing in 100-degree water is perfectly safe.
Okay, so if we're going to do this at home, what would be the exact method we should use?
Well, first of all, the method should only really be used for relatively small cuts of meat, like steaks, chops, chicken breasts, chicken legs, things like that. Not whole birds, not whole roasts, because those still, even in hot water, will take hours to thaw all the way to the center. And so it should really only be for these smaller cuts of meat and fish. And what you want to do is actually start the water hotter, because the second study that I had seen actually tried it in 125 or 130-degree water, uh-huh. and that works well and even faster. So what I like to do is just get the water hot from the tap, and that's usually around, in my house, around 120 degrees, and then have a lot of water compared to the weight of the meat. So a big stock pot full of water, and then put the meat in, immerse it, put something on it like a saucer or a slotted spoon just to keep it submerged. Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while come over and give it a stir, because you will get hot and cold spots if the water just sits quietly by itself, and the thawing won't be as quick and efficient as it would be otherwise. And then in 15 minutes, depending on the thickness of the meat, it should be ready to go.
What about packaging? Because if I take something right out of the freezer, sometimes I wrap first in freezer plastic wrap, then I wrap again. Should I leave it in that wrapping, or should I transfer the stuff into something different for the thawing?
Well, the thawing is slowed down by anything that's between the meat and the water. And so it'll be most efficient to thaw if the meat is simply in a single thickness piece of plastic film. Or if you've kind of packaged it yourself and swaddled it in layers and layers, take off the swaddling and just put it in a Ziploc bag. And that way the heat will be transferred from the water into the meat much more rapidly.
You have just opened up possibilities for home cooks on weeknights that are untold. Harold, thank you. This is great.
My pleasure.
Food scientist Harold McGee is author of Keys to Good Cooking. Well, we're going to be back in a moment with our kind of workout with a personal trainer, one who trains you how to be a better wine taster. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. know, if you're one of those people who think they don't know a good wine from a bad one, we're here to tell you that there's a solution. You can train yourself with a few simple tools you probably have in your kitchen, and soon you can be throwing around words like malolactic fermentation, tannins, and oak with the best of them. Food & Wine Magazine senior wine editor Megan Kriegbaum sat down with New York Times columnist Melissa Clark for a training session.
Megan, so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
As you know, I love drinking wine. You know that well. But I really want to be a better taster. I want to be better at tasting wine. So how can you help me?
So we did this story at Food & Wine last October, and I went to a bunch of experts to sort of figure out what are the main components that you need to know about to taste wine. This is something that sort of takes you into the food world rather than directly into the wine world, which is a little bit easier to understand. I went to Josh Wesson, who's this kind of amazing wine knowledge person, and he's just a tremendous brain, and he does a lot of speaking and education. So everyone thinks there's a right or wrong when it comes to tasting wine, but really the truth is there are just a handful of components that you can know about to be a better wine taster. So I'm going to show you how to taste for tannin, sweetness, and oak. And the first one that is really big and sort of hard to understand is tannin.
Yeah, because you hear that associated with wine all the time, but then where else do we find tannin? Where else does it exist in the world?
Yeah, tannin, you can find tannin in walnuts, okay. Sort of that little bitter
yep.
thing. But what Josh told me about is the tannin that you find in black tea. So just some really simple packs of Lipton tea can mm-hmm. teach you a lot about tannin. So what I have here is I've made 2 cups of tea for you. One was steeped for 2 minutes.
Okay.
And one is steeped for 4 minutes. And tannin really is a textural component
Should
when
I try
it comes
these?
To wine. Yeah.
Mmm, tea. Okay, I see. So the second one is there's a bitterness, there's almost a raspiness on my tongue.
Yeah, it should feel kind of almost dry yes. in this way, like that your palate is really sort of cleaned off and you get that sort of bitterness in the back of your throat.
The 2-minute cup is perfect as it is. The 4-minute cup, I want a little milk.
Right.
I want to mitigate that.
Exactly. And you could probably go a little even more extreme on this and do an 8-minute cup as well, and then you would really get that tannin in your face, but it's not very pleasant for sure.
So now that I've tasted those, you've got 2 wines for me to taste?
Sure. So the first wine that I'm going to pour for you is this Beaujolais. And this is from Burgundy. It's from Southern Burgundy, and it's from an amazing producer named Marcel Lapierre. He actually died a couple years ago, but his legacy carries on, and he makes this gorgeous wine. And it's made from the Gamay grape. This would be the one that's lower in tannin.
Oh, that's delicious. So what's this next one?
So then this next one is a Bordeaux. It's okay. mostly Merlot. And so this, you should taste that dryness, the similarity to the black teas.
Oh, that's delicious too. But yes, that one dries my tongue out immediately. You know, it's funny. With the wine, I don't mind my tongue being dried out. But with the tea, it's disconcerting. It's interesting, maybe because I expect it. What in wine accounts for the tannins?
It's part of the grape. So you can get tannins either from the skins or uh-huh. from the seeds of the grape. So when they press the grapes, if they press them really hard, you'll get a lot of tannin extracted from the seeds. And if they press them lightly, you won't so much. And then also the skins, the thicker the skin, the more tannin you'll have.
I see. So in a wine like the Beaujolais, it's probably quickly pressed. They don't have a lot of skin contact.
Right.
And it's a brighter, lighter wine. And then with the Bordeaux, we're getting thicker
right.
types of grapes.
Longer time on the skins, more seed influence.
So, Megan, is there an ideal amount of tannin that you're looking for in a wine?
Well, I think it depends on what you're going to drink it with. I mean, ideally, you would drink this Bordeaux with something sort of either rich or meaty, something really substantial. You want the fat to pair up with tannin. With something lighter like Beaujolais, you could almost drink it on its own, but it would also go well with like lighter foods, you know, chicken or vegetables or something like that.
Seafood, something.
Seafood, yeah. The Beaujolais is like the red wine for seafood. Not much can go in the red world with seafood.
Now, what's the next component that you're going to show me?
So the next component is sweetness. And what I have for you here is a glass of essentially lemon juice. We took about a cup of water and we squeezed the juice of half of a lemon into it. And it's very concentrated. So I'd like for you to taste that now.
But wait,
on its
that
own.
Doesn't sound very sweet to me.
Not sweet yet at okay. all.
Ooh, sour.
Super
Ooh.
Tart, right?
Yes.
So we have this
Ooh.
Some sugar for you.
Yes,
and
please.
What I'd
Lots
like you
it.
To do is sort of start, put a little sugar in and stir it in and then taste that and
okay.
see how you're doing with that.
I'm just going to really just add a lot of sugar
yeah,
here because
great.
That is quite tart. It's like it's lemonade without the sugar, which, as my daughter will tell you, Mommy, put more sugar in there. Okay. Mm, okay.
And so that's probably pretty balanced at that point. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. You still have the tartness of it, which is really nice, but you'll also have the sweetness. So we're kind of in the realm of talking about Rieslings that can be either really sweet or not sweet at all in the dry realm or sort of somewhere in the middle.
So what's the right balance between acidity and sweetness? I mean, what are you really looking for when you try to choose a good white wine?
Well, I think you might want something that's very dry, very tart on a really hot summer day. When you're sitting outside, hanging out with your friends, having a picnic, you might want something super refreshing like that. But then you might want something with a little bit of sugar to it. Maybe if you're having scallops on the grill or something a little richer, it's nice to have a little bit of fruit. Even something spicy, some like Thai food that has some good heat to it.
Right, Riesling and Thai food.
That. Exactly. And then if you went a little further, and so that would be a pretty sweet example, and that you can still do that with some spicy food, but you also could do that with more dessert kind of items.
I was always told with a dessert wine that the dessert should be as sweet as the wine. They should be equal. Is that?
I think really you want the wine to be sweeter
than the
dessert.
The wine to be sweeter. Okay.
Yeah. I think that's the ideal. The next one I want to show you about is tasting oak and wine. So we all know that a lot of wines end up in a barrel at some point. Sometimes the barrel has a lot of influence because it's new and freshly toasted, and sometimes it has minimal influence because it's old. So Josh told me that if you take some Cheerios, so here are some Cheerios for you.
Okay.
Take them in your hand and crush them up.
Got it.
Now give it a big smell.
Oh, yeah.
It's oaty in this way, but it's toasty, and it kind of gives you the idea of what maybe an oaked Chardonnay would taste like or a white wine that has oak influence, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it smells a little bit ever so slightly smoky, but not a lot, just a little bit.
Right. It also has that vanilla-y flavor to it.
And the vanilla comes from the oak as well.
Exactly, those notes. And then another funny little experiment that Josh taught me about is with some toasted marshmallows. So we toasted these marshmallows just over a flame on the stove. If you give those a smell, this will kind of give you a sense of what oak does to red wine. So it gives this sweet, smoky toastiness. I was totally blown away by that one. I had never heard that before.
Wow. Toasted marshmallows. This really does smell like some Cabernets I've had in the past. Very, very oaky, and it smells great. Wow. Well, Megan, thank you so much. I feel like next time I taste wines, I'll really know how to identify what I'm smelling in the glass and what I'm tasting.
Thank you.
Megan Kriegbaum is senior wine editor for Food & Wine magazine, and Melissa Clark's latest book is Franny's Simple Seasonal Italian. Well, Melissa left us with a crostini recipe that is perfect on a summer evening, roasted cherry tomatoes with ricotta, and it's at splendidtable.org. Where to eat great Italian food in Rome? Well, I hear it's not as easy as it once was. The days of you can't get a bad meal in Italy never really existed, but friends tell me it's a lot easier to eat poorly there than it used to be. And there's one snag. You see, the integrity of Italian restaurant critics is not always a dominant characteristic. Be wary of local guides. Critics often care a lot more about what they gain from sending tourists to their pals' places than what a visitor, who will be in another city tomorrow night, thinks of their dinner. Your best bet is to check out the straight shooters like Katie Parla, who blogs at parlafood.com. Katie's a trained sommelier and holds an MA in Italian food and culture. She joins us from her base in Rome. Katie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So is it a myth that Italians generally are pickier about their food than Americans?
You know, I think once upon a time, you could say that Italians sort of had great palates because the ingredients that they were consuming were local and seasonal, and things that don't travel very far just tend to taste better. But that's really changed in the past decade or two. And now because of the financial crisis, people are more attracted to what they perceive as value than flavor.
So what form does that take?
You find that the portions in restaurants have grown while the ingredients that go into them have actually diminished in quality, and people are willing to overlook that in cases in which they leave a restaurant feeling full. People still do want to go out and have their dining ritual and spend time with their friends and eat. They can't afford to have multiple meals every month out at restaurants, so they sort of make up for this by just really diving into huge portions at lots of local places.
But I do know there are still places, little places all over the country where the food can be quite exquisite and not very expensive.
Definitely. It's important to know where to go. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head. A lot of local guides or or locals in Rome, know that when they send you to a place, you're probably moving on to another city or not coming back. So they're less interested in your experience and maybe the kickbacks they might receive.
So where should we eat? We come to Rome. We want to taste the food of Rome. What dishes should we look for and where should we be eating?
There's been a fantastic rebirth in sort of street food culture. Hundreds of years ago, people used to do a lot of eating out on the street simply because there weren't facilities to cook inside their houses or houses were fire prone. And so now, because of the financial crisis and because of this sort of niche movement to eat quality things, you have the rise of street food stalls. And there's a fantastic place in the new Testaccio market called Morte e Vai, where you can go and get a sandwich with bits of oxtail or boiled beef. It's all drenched in this really delectable oil.
Oh.
You get really flavorful things for a price that everyone can afford. These sandwiches cost €3.
This sort of seems like the food trucks in cities here, and a lot of the food is fabulous. But it's also a way that very established chefs who are, you know, have expensive restaurants can do wonderful food but charge a lot less for it.
Definitely. Stefano Caligari is the one that comes most to mind. He opened this fantastic gourmet pizzeria called Sforno in Cinecittà, so a neighborhood in Rome.
Right.
And the second business that he opened was a little hole-in-the-wall pizza-by-the-slice shop that really took off because of his street food invention called the Trapizzino.
What is that?
And it's this, it's a very spongy piece of flatbread that's sliced open and filled with braised meat stews or chicken with bell peppers, typical Roman mains that are transformed into a portable and inexpensive form. And the Trapizzino now is served in restaurants all over Rome.
This sounds fabulous. Now, where else?
Well, I think everyone wants that fantastic trattoria meal.
Right.
For your classic pasta dishes, like an eggy carbonara, you must visit Cesare al Casaletto. It's a fantastic place. It's so easy to get to. It's outside of the center, but it's at the very end of the 8 tram for €1.50. You're transported to this really fantastic, like homey Roman environment. They do spectacular fried appetizers, and then really great meaty mains like meatballs and oxtail. The wine list is sensational. So certainly for the trattoria meal, Cesare is the place.
Okay.
And you must start with the fried appetizers. Just get fried everything. Every item on the fried appetizer menu should be on your table before you even think about your pasta course and main.
I understand. What's another one?
Pizzarium is one of the most important places to eat. It's a hole in the wall. It's like 300 square feet, including the prep space. And that's where Gabriele Bonci has turned pizza by the slice into an art form. Vogue dubbed him the Michelangelo of pizza. And you can get really fantastic pizza rossa. It's a simple, long-leavened pizza base with a really lovely olive oil-rich tomato sauce. The other pizza that you must try there is the pizza with potatoes, sort of a ubiquitous topping in Rome, but here it takes on a completely new consistency. The potatoes are amazingly flavorful. They sort of melt into the dough with the cheese. Pizzarium is certainly a must visit.
Okay, one of my favorite Roman dishes, pasta amatriciana, the pasta with the spicy, hot tomato sauce with guanciale in it. Where do I get that?
Okay, I'm going to blow your mind right now.
Okay.
You can unify amatriciana sauce and potato gnocchi in one location. It's called L'Arcangelo, and he makes the most perfectly pillowy potato gnocchi on Thursdays and dresses it with that guanciale, cured pork jowl-rich sauce, tomatoes that are cultivated in his hometown just outside of Rome, and a really fantastic sharp pecorino cheese, a little bit of black pepper. It's spectacular.
Best cup of coffee in Rome.
That's easy. Sha-sha. It's in zero guidebooks, but it is a spectacular coffee shop in the Prati district. Prati is beside the Vatican. It's an overlooked neighborhood, and Sha-Sha has been in business since 1919. They roast their own beans, which is, of course, is important, but their baristas also are very skilled. They have this long historic tradition. By far, the best coffee in the city.
Katie, thank you. Mouth is watering. We know now what to expect.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Oh, it was great to be here.
Katie Parla is a food and wine writer based in Rome who runs tours. She blogs at parlafood.com. Now, to taste what was all the rage in the Rome of Julius Caesar, try soft-boiled eggs in pine nut sauce from historian Patrick Foss. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, when you think of tequila, you think of margaritas. But did you know that the agave plant that gives us tequila meant survival to the rural people of Mexico? It gave them medicine, clothing, shoes, drink, weapons, cattle feed, fuel, even the roofs over their heads. And that's all from one plant. Well, author Lucinda Hudson is a woman with Mexico in her heart and a fascination with tequila in her soul. It's been a life work for her, and she's the author of Viva Tequila, Cocktails, Cooking, and Other Agave Adventures. Lucinda, good to talk to you.
Oh, Leanne, good to be with you.
So how did tequila get to you? How did this all begin?
Well, I grew up in the border, El Paso, but I've been traveling through Mexico for the last four decades. And the plant, oh, it's such an amazing plant to think the magical transformation of producing tequila from the agave plant. You know, it's like a 6-foot artichoke out in the field, and those leaves have to be whacked off to reveal this starchy core that looks like a huge pineapple. And then that has to be baked to produce the fermentable sugars for distillation. Pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And from what I understand, there's many different kinds of agave plants, but there's only one kind of agave that gives us tequila.
That's right. And that's the blue agave that's just grown in 5 states in Mexico. There are many other 400 varieties of agaves, like you mentioned, that have had so much historical significance. But one blue agave makes tequila.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that we should understand about tequila? Because I know there are different kinds, but I'm not quite sure what those differences mean.
Well, another amazing thing for a spirit is there are 4 distinct styles. Once it comes out of the still, you have that beautiful, clear Blanco tequila that's vibrant and bright. Once it's aged for a short while in oak, we get the Reposado, the gently reposed tequila. And if it's aged longer, for 1 to 3 years or more, we get the Extra Añejo that brown spirits people will love, more like cognac or a good brandy or scotch or bourbon. So there's the Blanco, the Reposado, the Añejo, and the Extra Añejo.
It sounds like the white tequila would be the thing to drink if I really want to taste what that plant is about.
I think that's true, Lynn. You know, it's peppery, it's bright, it's fresh, it's clear, but you should still taste the flavor of the agave. And, you know, we know what grapes and grain taste like, but what does agave taste like? It's yammy, it's herbaceous, it's floral, it's like baking yams with molasses in a clay pot with desert rain. I love it.
Oh, my. Oh, my. The thing that I was really intrigued by, too, is that that agave plant has to be 10 years old before you make tequila?
Yes, and think grapes and grain, one harvest, 1 year. This plant takes about 10 years to grow in the field, and it needs maintenance throughout that time. So it's a long process. This is a very special spirit.
And then it shoots up one shoot that turns into a flower, can go up, what, 20 feet?
Yes, but we don't want it to do that. That has to be cut off about 6 months before the harvest, because otherwise those sugars would go into the sky to feed this flowering stalk. So that has to happen in the field too. It's that central core that we want to get the starch from and the sugar waters that are within it.
Yeah, because I mean, with grapes, you cut the grapes off the plant, but the plant lives.
Yeah.
With agave, you kill the plant to get what you drink.
The plant is gone. It looks like a war zone when they harvest it.
So now let's talk blends or a mixto. For instance, I'm just thinking of one brand off the top of my head, Cuervo Gold. What is that? Is that pure tequila?
Well, what we want to look for is 100% agave tequila, which you will see on the bottle. If it doesn't say that on the bottle, it means that added sugars can be added to the tequila. And you see it has to have at least 51% blue agave, but 49% could come from added sugars. And so it's not a pure agave tequila. So I encourage people to look for one that says 100% agave on the label.
Are there brands that you particularly favor?
Oh my gosh, there's so many that I love, and it's kind of up to you, but I love Tapatio Tequila, I love T1, I love Siete Leguas, I'm still a fan of Herradura Tequila, but my gosh, it just depends on your taste. Don't let anybody tell you what to drink. You know, you just have to sip and savor and figure it out for yourself.
So now, I know that the famous way of drinking tequila is, you know, straight with, what is it, you suck then on a lime?
Well, A lot of people do that, but I prefer just sipping without the lime or salt or anything. But traditionally in Jalisco, if you order a shot of tequila...
And that's where it's made, right? That's the
Yes, Jalisco is the main state of the five states. And so if you order a shot of tequila in Jalisco, what comes to the table accompanying it is a shot of sangrita, a non-alcoholic chaser. And this is... Sangrita means little blood because it's ripe. Bright red, and it's just the quintessential chaser for tequila. It's salty and sour and piquant.
What's in it?
Well, the traditional recipe is fresh orange juice, lime juice, pomegranate juice, and hot red chili salsa.
Wow.
I use one called Valentina, but unfortunately, you'll see people doing a Bloody Mary mix nowadays with tomato. Ugh. Mine has no tomato in it, so it's just so fresh and bright and delicious to sip at the same time with tequila.
Lucinda, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, Lynn, wonderful to be with you.
Viva Tequila is Lucinda Hudson's book, and she wants us to try a famous party punch recipe from the town of Guadalajara in Tequila's home territory of Jalisco. It's Guadalajara Punch, and the recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now we're going to be back with your questions and the latest from the Obesity Lab. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
Well, it is time for you and me to talk. I'm game to take on just about any question. Call me, 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. And Daniel's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Daniel, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You are welcome. What do you want to talk about?
My partner and I are going to be relocating to Turkey for about 8 months.
Where in Turkey?
We've rented a nice Ottoman townhouse in a quiet part of Istanbul.
Yes. Okay. Go on.
Yeah. So my question: we don't really know how well equipped the kitchen is, and we were wondering what sort of kitchen tools you might consider vital that you would take along from your own kitchen.
From my own kitchen? Okay. First of all, whenever I know I'm going to be staying anywhere, I always bring my own knives.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually, you know, the knives in any kind of place that you rent are not going to be very good. The other thing that it weighs down the suitcase, but I really, my 12-inch straight-sided sauté pan...
Really?
I'm not kidding. You know why? Because I do stews in it. You could do a soup in it. You could do, obviously, you can saute in it and you can roast in it if the oven's large enough to take the handle, which, you know, comes out at a slight angle.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the pot I use almost every day.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, you may have to buy a seat on the plane for the blessed thing. But if you possibly can, that's another thing. The other thing is my flat-bottomed wood spatulas. They weigh nothing, and I can move stuff around in a pan faster than you can say Jack Robinson with that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that I usually always bring anywhere I go. I also generally bring my vegetable peeler.
They are very personal.
They're very personal. I like a certain style. There's one I use that's very comfortable for my hand. And the other thing is, too, there are actually, they're kind of flexible. They're very lightweight, but they are plastic cutting sheets.
Cutting sheets, okay.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I can't remember where I found mine. I found them online. They're very portable. They're very light. Bring two of them, one for meat, one for veggies. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can then bend them. You know, after you've chopped all the vegetables, you can lift them up in that and, you know, take it over to that pan and dump it in. They're flexible.
Yeah, and that'll fit beautifully in the bottom of a suitcase.
Exactly. And that way you don't have to worry about a cutting board or that sort of thing. And of course, you know,
measuring spoons, in case you're going to do anything American and you're used to measuring spoon.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I think the whole adventure is, you know, making a strange kitchen work, even if it consists of one burner and, you know, a blowtorch.
We're hoping there's more than that.
Yeah, but you know, some of the greatest fun you'll have cooking. I stayed in a place where there was a old wood-fired stove. And boy, that was work. But boy, when you finished doing something that tasted good on that thing, you felt like you had climbed Mount Everest. You were just so happy. So I'd say immerse yourself in the place. And also, pick up stuff that you see there. You know, there are so many implements that are indigenous to a place. Often they're very cheap, but they're the kind of things that it'll be a memory for you, but it'll also be a way of maybe making a dish that you pick up from there.
That's good advice. Good life advice.
Yeah. And you know, you can schlep them home or you can even ship them if you have to.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you decide to do this?
My partner is a Roman historian. So when she goes to do research in the interesting places that the Romans went, sometimes I get to go along.
Very, very lucky for both of you. Enjoy it for all of us.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to be a Roman historian. And then I'd like to be an Asian historian so I can see all of Asia but see it through the eyes of the past to the present. That's my dream. Okay. 800-537-5252. That's how you can call us. And Michelle's calling from San Jose, California. Michelle, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I hope you can help me. I have a bit of a taste for hot food. And, of course, being so close in California, it's easy to get spicy food, Mexican, Thai food, every choice is available. But I'm really looking to authentically spice up some maybe Italian dishes or French dishes. I feel like they don't often have that natural kick I'm looking for, but I'm also looking for a way to do it that's maybe native. I don't want to throw a Mexican chili into a ratatouille.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as you know, it's so interesting you say this because, you know, everything in every country is very individual. You can say, well, the people in Paris eat this way. And then you find out that there are people in Paris that don't eat that way. I was going to say, generally, you tend to find spicier, more piquant food in the south of Italy than in the north. But the reality is that's not always true. There's more hot pepper. Peperoncini is the hot pepper of Italy. That's the reference for it. You find more of it in the south, and I think because it grows there and because the south has more influences on its tastes from the Arab world.
Okay. Yeah.
And North Africa, because remember, the Arabs dominated Sicily and the Greeks, well, the Greeks were eating milder food, but the Arabs dominated Sicily for I don't know how many years, at starting 1,000 years ago. And all those things, and also places like Sicily and the toe of the boot, they were like 125 or 90 miles from the coast of North Africa. So if you look at the dishes of Sicily, Puglia, Calabria, Basilicata, even Campania, which is where Naples is, you're going to find some dishes that have a fair amount of piquant flavor. But I have been in family homes in the north where, for instance, I have a cousin who really believed that black pepper was not healthy because she believed it was fermented and it wasn't healthy. And here she is, a Tuscan classical cook, you know, in the middle of Tuscany. And what is she doing? She's adding little pinches of hot red pepper flakes to her food. Now, you barely noticed it, but the reality was it was a wonderful addition. It just lifted things.
No, that's so funny. When I was in Florence for studying abroad, there was our nonna who would warn us when she made her special spicy red sauce for the pasta. And all of us students would just look at each other and like, I think she sprinkled a couple red flakes in here. It was just nothing to us, but in her world, it was just the spiciest food, and it was so funny. And I think it was just a little red chili.
Yeah, but I think part of it is a lot of people feel that, you know, chili can cover up. It kills. Yep. It's you know, it's like too much cream in a dish. And I think in the eyes of especially, you know, people who are very traditional, the adding of a hot flavor to a dish that they've known all their lives as having no heat whatsoever, but having other flavors, they feel it's a, you know, well, as you said, you wanted to do it with respect. So I would look at more dishes from the southern part of Italy than the northern part. And, you know, if you look at, there's some really good cookbooks out there that look at the foods of southern Italy. There's one called The Heart of Sicily by Anna Tosca Lanza.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's, well, you know, there's an old book by a man named Mario Midiglioni. And I think it's called The Food of Southern Italy. And it is, that thing must have come out in the 80s. The recipes will make you weep. You'll be so happy.
I just love flipping through old cookbooks. Well, thank you so much.
You are very welcome. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too. All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. Also, send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. You don't forget Dr. James Levine, if you can keep up with him. You see, he's a movement expert who discovered NEAT, the system he believes will beat obesity and poor health. NEAT is his acronym for Non-Exercise Activity Thermogenesis. In other words, the everyday movements that we've lost with technology. For instance, pace whenever you're on the phone and lose maybe 40 pounds this year. At our first interview, we never sat. We trotted, that's his walking pace. We stood and we walked at his treadmill desk during the entire recording. So where has NEAT taken Dr. James Levine since then? He's at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, and he's co-director of the Mayo Clinic Arizona State University Obesity Solutions Initiative. Dr. Levine, good to have you back with us.
Oh, what a pleasure to be back.
Now, we talked quite a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think I was on your treadmill desk at the time when we were talking. But I want to catch up. What is standing out now about the work you've been doing over these past years?
Lynn, I mean, what has literally blown my mind is over a very, very short period of time, this science that colleagues of mine and our team at Mayo were conducting, really demonstrating not only the impact of moving throughout the day on weight management, but also on diabetes, blood pressure, and even how we feel every day,
right,
has escaped the laboratory and impacted society in multiple corporations. And I mean, I don't just mean large, wealthy corporations. I mean small businesses, medium-sized and large businesses, realizing and recognizing that healthy employees work better, healthy employees are happier, and healthcare costs associated with healthy employees are less. And it has become evident that the more movement that is interlaced into the workday, the healthier and happier people become. And nutrition follows as well, of course, Lynn, as you and I know, is that when people feel better about themselves, they're more interested in sort of cooking really good quality, beautiful meals. And so these two things go hand in hand. And that is what I've noticed. And very interestingly, it's not just corporations, of course, but it's individuals at home, it's schools. All of a sudden, you get this sense that the nation is sort of, I would say, started to rise up, if you like, and you know, and this health opportunity is upon us and is now mainstream.
There was something that you did where you fed people mm-hmm. an extra 1,000 calories a day. What was this test about? 1,000 calories a day more than you would normally eat?
Absolutely right. So what we learned was that when we overfed people in a laboratory setting, of course, very, very carefully controlled, and we knew all of the calories going in, and we also knew how all of the calories were burnt. What we discovered is that those people who are up and moving around throughout the day, those people are the ones who burn off all those extra calories. And actually, some people, even with that amount of excess overfeeding, don't gain weight. It's not necessarily the fidgeting that burns off the calories, but we would argue that the fidgeting is sort of like, it's sort of like the sparks flying. It sort of shows you that a person has the, is about to jump up, is about to move, wants to move. Their brain is sort of sending fidgets as if to say, come on, get up. But really, it's that up and walking around throughout the day that is very, very powerful for health and very, very powerful for helping people control body weight.
But what happens if you're not one of those people? Is it a case of consciously standing up and moving every, I don't know, 40 minutes or so? I mean, is that the way you reprogram yourself?
You have it absolutely spot on. I mean, the most powerful organ in the whole body, the solution driver in the whole body is, of course, the brain, the consciousness. And so taking upon a sort of a conscious drive, setting a little timer on the work desk, the post-it note, lots of what I would call mind-based or intellectual tricks, that is the way forward. It is literally to engage individuals in their own solutions. And we now have a very, very large interest in helping people devise individual solutions. But what comes back to us so often is, you know, doc, I try to do those things, but, you know, I've got to get the kids to, you know, camp. I've got another job I've taken on with the Economic Times. I just can't fit all that stuff in you asked me to do. What we've come to realize is we need to almost, it's almost as if I could sit down with everyone in America for an hour, we could do all of this, but that's not possible. So how do you therefore build a series of solutions that meet individual needs?
Mm-hmm.
And the way we're addressing that is literally to work with databases of actually, in some cases, millions of individuals to find out what's working for different people and build a solution base to help individuals. Because I think, you know, it is that individualization, just as with food, we need to do for physical activity. That's where we're going.
Practical solutions.
Correct.
James Levine, thank you for talking with us.
Lynn, it has been, as always, my pleasure.
Dr. James Levine is an obesity researcher based at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona. His book is Move a Little, Lose a Lot. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Anonymous, who said, "You aren't going to get the butt you want by sitting on the one you have." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head over to splendidtable.org for more information on just about anything you heard here today. You're going to find information on our latest ebooks and podcasts. There are loads of recipes and ideas. And be sure to register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our weekly attempt at bringing you good food midweek. That's splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.